Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. This is your host, Dan Turchin, advisor at Insight Finder, the system of intelligence for IT operations, and CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. Thanks again for making this one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. If you enjoy what we do, please like, comment, and share in your favorite podcast app, and we'll keep sharing great conversations. Now, we're recording this on December 26th, and it's our last episode until 2022. We've had an incredible past year here on the podcast. We've now published over 100 episodes. And, you know, if you look back at the arc of the conversations we've been having, you'll find three distinct themes emerge. The first theme, AI is all about data, how we collect it, store it, transform it, and use it. The second theme that's common is for AI to be trusted, automated decisions must be transparent, replicable, and explainable. That is, you need to know when decisions are made on your behalf using AI, and those decisions must be made in ways that are fair. And I'd say the third theme that comes up on a consistent basis is that the future of work is what I've called ambient intelligence. Better answers will come to you before you know you have a question. In previous episodes, we've talked about this in the context of self-booking conference rooms, self-healing networks, business trips that plan themselves. All of these things, as we've learned, are well less than a decade away. I encourage you to listen to some of these conversations from the archives. You'll get a PhD in AI just by hearing from the technologists, the investors, policymakers, and entrepreneurs that we've talked to who are truly out there creating the future. Now, on today's show, we get to discuss all of these trends with a real disruptor who has been in the space for nearly a decade. Luke Aragone started Arecor in 2012 to help large companies unlock the power of their data. Since then, he and the team have helped organizations like AT&T, UPS, and Goldman Sachs solve business problems with applications of AI, including computer vision, neural nets, machine learning, and NLP. Before Arecor, Luke was a data scientist and software architect, having studied math at Columbia. Without further ado, it is really my pleasure to welcome Luke to the podcast. Luke, let's kick things off. Why don't you share a little bit about your background and how you got into the space?
Well, first off, I'm really excited to be here. I think this platform is an excellent place to talk about AI. So thank you for having me. So a little bit about my background. You know, you teed it up so well. You know, the last 10 years, you know, there's been a change in the nomenclature around our industry. You know, there's big data, we called it for a while, and you know, algorithm development. But you know, here we are in almost 22, and we all collectively call it data science. But for the last 10 years, there's been one big theme, which is, can you take data, find insight, and either reduce your costs or increase profitability? So my team has been kind of diligently working in that department for a while. But it was largely founded after a startup where we did some data science work. And then, you know, like I said, it was kind of back before it was a thing. And so we just started getting lots of calls. It was built off of a big referral system until we, you know, we had something that, you know, we could consistently get more and more work from. So it kind of came from a need from the industry and less of us trying to go out and find the work and more of like, I think we should just build a company around this thing that keeps coming to us.
Your list of clients reads like the Wall Street Journal. Tell us a story about a particular client that stands out, but maybe a story that makes you most proud.
I have a fun one, UPS. So, you know, UPS, they have this thing where what they really want to do is when all packages come in or out of the United States, they want to attach a tax code to it, a harmonized tax code. And this right now is, you know, it's a complicated task, requires actually a lot of knowledge around tariffs and customs. And what they wanted to do was just use NLP, you know, neural nets to largely make this a more automated process. And so they called us and they're like, hey, we had IBM Watson give it a shot and it's terrible. It's like 16% accuracy. And we were wondering if maybe you could give it a shot. So like, yeah, let's do it. So we went into it kind of trying to, beat IBM, right? And we were expecting maybe we would get, you know, 30 or 40%. And for UPS, giving high confidence on maybe 10% of their items is still a pretty big improvement. And we killed it. We smashed it. We had a unique architecture type for the net. And we ended up getting like 90 some odd percent accuracy. And, you know, this was, you know, it was something we were enormously proud of. Being able to beat the Watson team was pretty exciting. But I think we were all kind of pleasantly surprised by that.
You could just pick at random and beat 16%. It's hard to believe that they paid Watson to achieve 16% accuracy.
You know, if you wanted to, we could get into an hour on this whole thing around, you know, basically AI isn't just a hammer. People need to know how to wield it. And the IBM Watson team, they have this enormous infrastructure. They have so much computing power that really they can take a bunch of data and just like run it through the machine and see what comes back out. But that's also a crutch. So like if you're just thinking, I'm going to dump a ton of data into a huge computer and get back the insights, you're going to be mistaken. And so I think that's, you know, some of the errors they made. And this was several years ago. I don't want to speak ill about any team now. I'm sure that was just a one-off thing. But at the same time, you know, your listeners and others should be kind of knowledgeable about the fact that it's more than just the computation. It's more than the data, you know, trying to think in a clever way of how do I teach this machine something fundamental. It's definitely going to net you better results.
It's a common theme we talk about, AI being kind of a fusion of art and science.
Yes. Yeah.
So with that being said, talk us through your process. So UPS approaches you maybe with this business problem. Mm-hmm. Where do you start?
So the first thing we really want to do is understand the business. Like what are you really trying to solve? Right. Because we do all the boring stuff, right? So we'll get down into the calculus of it. Right. And that's nothing that our clients need to be concerned about. We obviously will walk them through if they're interested. Something I'm sure we'll talk about is being able to understand these models. But part of it is, in the beginning at least, is what business problem are you trying to solve? Are you trying to save money? Are you trying to make money? Are you trying to innovate? Right. And so for this space, like with UPS, it was, we have a huge cost center, which is humans are doing this work. And we think we can either improve their work or maybe even cut out a portion of it to be automated. And so we take all the data that they give us and we start building prototypes. You know, and the first prototype we built basically matched Watson. We're like, oh, this is the strategy that Watson picked, right? How do we beat this strategy, right? As soon as we go out of the gate, we identify like, how do we make this thing better? And after two or three tries or whatever, you iterate and you figure out, you know, how can I build something that would, like I said, teach this machine the problem? And then we go back with this prototype and we say, hey, this is the pros and cons of it. I don't want to say that every time it's a win, right? Oftentimes we do have wins. It's something that we're enormously grateful for. But, you know, sometimes you go back to the client and you say, you know, we've looked at your data. We know what business problem you're trying to solve. And unfortunately, there are limitations there. This is as far as we can get. And, you know, we can pass this off in case your team wants to figure it out. Or maybe there's another team that's better than us, right? Whatever it is, it's really a very transparent conversation around, you know, this is what we can do with your data. Then they decide, well, let's make this into a big production project. Or, you know, I think it'll be okay. And we'll pause here.
So part of the challenge of building AI models is what I'll call data engineering as much as data science. Talk to us about how you approach the data engineering aspect of the problem when you first see, let's say, a data set and you have to coach a client or a potential client through the process of creating hygiene, you know, where data is presumably dirty to start with.
No, I mean, that's such a knowledgeable question. Our industry is definitely riddled with a deficiency in data engineering, right? We love to talk about data science, but unfortunately there is this kind of, you know, elephant in the room, which is oftentimes the data is nowhere near ready to be able to build these models. And so when we talk to the client, usually in the prototype stage, it's lots of disclaimers, right? We'll say, hey, you know, this is us basically pulling it into a single machine and we are, you know, we're going to try and clean the data to the best of our knowledge. Like there's a lot of disclosures that are given because we know that when we take it to production, there's so much more effort that goes into automating the pipeline, cleaning that pipeline, looking for data shift, right? There's so many elements that need to be considered, including things like monitoring and logging and alerting if there's issues. And so when we talk about data engineering, we basically sweep it under the rug for the prototype stage, because we want to know that our whole goal is how do we, with the least amount of resources, the least amount of money, figure out if there's a real thing here, right? So we tend to kind of avoid the data engineering in the beginning. But as soon as the client says, yeah, this is valuable, the next thing, I mean, priority zero is how much is it going to cost through the data engineering work before we build that prod model? Because as you've illuminated, that's not actually a trivial thing to solve. Oftentimes they'll need, you know, Apache Airflow, and they'll need EMR, right? They'll, whatever infrastructure they're in, they'll need some kind of Spark cluster. And they may or may not be aware of that. And we have to kind of educate them around the expenses and probably most likely in every scenario, upskilling their team, right? But yeah, no, there's a whole conversation we get to have after the prototype stage.
Okay, so you prototype a model, and let's say you benchmark some precision and recall. And like you alluded to, in production, there's data drift, things change, new categories, you know, emerge, other ones are removed. At my company, PeopleRain, we offer what we call an AI managed service, because the fact is, you know, it takes, you know, some amount of introspecting of the model on an ongoing basis to maintain the highest, you know, precision and recall. Do you have a similar concept, or how are you involved once the model's in production?
So when the model actually goes to prod, there's a whole process that we try to engage in, which is, you know, obviously there's data engineering we talked about and the data science part, which is really fun, but the less fun, but just as crucial is upskilling, or at least doing some level of education with the teams that currently exist. It's such a new industry. It is presumptuous to go in and say, here it is, let me drop it off of your doorstep and then leave, right? So we will talk to DevOps teams, infrastructure teams, software development teams, and including data science teams that may or may not exist on in the organization. And so when it's in prod, we basically start this march to making sure everyone can run it. We say that old, you know, adage around, you know, if I get hit by a bus, right? Well, we tell the client up front, like the whole goal is that our whole team at Aerocore can get hit by a bus and you don't have this black box sitting out there. So I would say 90%+ of our work after production is really making sure that you don't need us anymore.
I didn't intend for this to be an ad for Aerocore, but I know.
No, I apologize. I should say in a more generic way,
yeah.
Whoever you get to do this, because I do want to highlight that even if it's internal, I have seen so many times, it's too many to count, that people will build a black box and set it up and then they leave jobs, right? So even if it's an internal, if it's an employee, it's another consulting agency, I would stress to your listeners that there's always some kind of contingency around education. Never let these things become black boxes, because they become so much harder to maintain. So no matter who's doing it, Aerocore or otherwise, I hope everyone thinks about that next stage. Even though it's not sexy, it's definitely needed for production.
All right, so let's move forward. So the model's in production and the client expresses a concern that it's making decisions that maybe are perceived as inaccurate or worse, maybe biased. What responsibility do you and your team have for the veracity, or not just for the accuracy, but, you know, for the fairness of the decisions that are being made?
Yeah. So I would say legally none, right? But that's not how you build a business. So none of our clients would say, you know, we want to, you know, engage in some litigation with Aerocore because we feel like this model is biased. That's never happened. But that's like the bare minimum. That's like saying, you know, like I'm going to get up in the morning. Really what we try to do in terms of our responsibilities are, you know, one, training data needs to not be biased. If you have biased training data, it will be reflected in the model, right? So oftentimes when we get, because we have occasionally had people come back after it's in prod and say, hey, we think this model might be biased towards X scenario. The first thing we do is we take that seriously and we go and find it in the training data. And, you know, more often than not, that is the problem, right? Is there was something that maybe wasn't discussed, you know, our fault, someone's fault, doesn't really matter. But at some point during prototype and production, there was a scenario that we did not consider. And so the bias would be considered after someone says, usually it's someone that's distant from the project that looked at it and says, hey, I just know this product really well, right? And then we all kind of do the, ah, yeah, of course, of course. And then we go and we fix the training data and fix the model accordingly.
So here's a thought experiment. So let's say you engage with a client and you see that they might have either a blind spot or maybe even, you know, some intention for a model to make automated decisions that could discriminate against a certain race or gender. You see it because you've done this before and, you know, you see how this is going to play out. Are you obligated to flag that to them? And, you know, could you envision ever confronting a client because of a potential harm that you could see from the AI model?
Absolutely. And part of doing business today is looking out for your clients that way. Right. So it's not my client's job to know what AI would end up being biased on in the data. Right. It goes back to that initial, really, they want to solve a business problem. And I need to be smart enough. My team needs to be smart enough to know they also don't want to isolate their customers. Right. So like they want to do good and they also don't want to do bad. Right. So it's absolutely our responsibility. And, you know, we actually have had that conversation. And more often than not, it's actually in open source models that are trained on biased data sets. And so someone will say, hey, can we just get this quick win and use X model? And, you know, we'll say, yeah, that's great. You should know, though, that based on this paper that we also read, there's some concern around, you know, some biases that could exist, sociological biases that may exist in this data that you would you perhaps be liable to or just exposed to. And, you know, every client makes a decision based on that. Some say, you know what, we get it. That's fine. We'll just put human in the loop or we don't even care. But others will say, no, you need to take that network model and we'll give you our data and we'll make sure it's not biased. And so then we're a partner in that process of how do we curate a non-biased data set, which is also non-trivial.
We've talked quite a bit in previous episodes about the importance of AI explainability. And you use the term no black box AI models. Mm-hmm. These are concepts that are very simple to talk about at a high level. But as you and I know, in production, it's often hard to, you know, unpack the layers that go into an automated decision. What's your perspective on how you make AI explainable?
Yeah, you perfectly nailed that problem. Some of the older machine learning models, they have something like LIME, right? There's these kind of out of the box packages you can dump a model into and it'll tell you, you know, 30% of the decision is based on this column, this feature, you know, and more and more today, as our models get more complex, as you've highlighted, that can't be done, right? Or it can't be done easily. And so it's definitely important that we try to engage in this effort to explain the AI. Like, so if it's a neural net, we'll say it's a very complicated neural network, right? Many layers, a lot of data, you know, perhaps the network architecture is very complicated. When someone says, well, can you explain it? Why did it make X decision? We do try to find good effort. Like we will basically exhaust some degree of brute force around this problem set to figure out, okay, it's because of such and such item. It's because of this column. But it's, you know, it's a growing problem and we basically have a unique conversation per client on it. Everyone wants to know, well, how do we explain it? And unfortunately, I can't say go to this Python package and grab it today, or here's my great blueprint. I'll leave that to future smarter people than I. Right now though, I'm just make sure that it is a meaningful conversation. Like one, how much do you want to know about the model? Because some people say, you know, if it works, I don't care. And then if they say, well, I want to know a lot, then we just talk about it. Like, okay, do you want to know the column level? Do you want to know like row level, like prediction level? What makes sense for you? And then we try to accommodate that as best we can.
At the top of the show, I mentioned one of the themes that comes up a lot is, and this is a little bit of editorializing on my part because I happen to feel strongly about this, but when decisions are made on our behalf, let's say as consumers, whether it's Netflix recommendations or, you know, Amazon purchase, whatever it is, we should be made aware that an algorithm was used to make that decision on our behalf. In practice, so you're on the front lines of creating some of the models that make these decisions. Do you agree that that's a priority? And if so, How do you operationalize that?
So this is something I think is currently up for debate. I think for most of my clients, they don't want AI to be seen at all. They don't want it to be highlighted. They don't want it to be present. They don't want to show their customers a cool new thing has done this. They really just want it to just float in the background. And so, you know, what you're describing is antithetical to a lot of that. And I don't know if I could say either way. I could say pros and cons for both, right? One, if they're making decisions on behalf of myself as a consumer, yeah, I probably do want to know, is this an automated decision or a human decision? But strangely, I'm not sure if I would discount the computer one to a human one. There's oftentimes, I think, that humans don't make great decisions either, right? So if it's like, hey, a human curated this clothing line for you, right? That's a huge thing these days. There's like a package you get and it's like your fashion, right? Or if it said, you know, an AI algorithm designed it, I'm not sure which one I would preference, right? And so I think that it's going to become more normalized to say this was, you know, decided by a human or by a computer or by, you know, analytics, right? So it's not machine learning. It's not, you know, non-deterministic. It's just like, you were the average of this, that, right? It's like how Pandora used to do it, right? Why did, were you served this song? But as it stands today, you know, it's not a conversation a lot of clients want to have about like, hey, let's highlight this to consumers.
So as AI developers, we're often maybe even, you know, unintentionally put in ethical quandaries. And I go back to kind of the classical problem that ethicists weigh, called the trolley problem. So the engineer of the trolley has a decision to make. Do you turn left and hit a school bus full of children, or do you turn right and hit an elderly woman crossing the street? And you have to decide between one or the other. And, you know, at some level, there's an algorithm developer who's maybe unintentionally having to code some logic that might end up making that kind of decision. How do you think about the responsibility that your team has when potentially very impactful decisions could be made based on your code?
You know, I have probably a cop-out answer for that, which is, you know, I really make sure the business understands the trolley problem and I make sure that they make that call. And we, of course, can reflect it in the machine learning and in the training and, you know, what we decide, you know, precision metrics on. But that is a conversation that we have every time. And we always say, like, what are your priorities as a company? Because we don't want to assume. It's not something we can. As far as AI developers' responsibility, it is 100% not your responsibility to make that call. You should not be making that call in isolation. It's almost like it should be a made by committee type conversation. If you are a AI developer and you are going through it and you're like, I'm just going to just decide, I think this is the best, that's probably the only wrong way to do it. I would strongly recommend you reach out to a business or a stakeholder and say, how do we form a committee to like make the best call here? And then, of course, you can reflect that decision in your code, in your model structure, but making kind of an authoritarian decision is probably the only wrong way to do it.
You and I can have this comfortable conversation about data and models and how they're used and automated decisions. But I think we both probably find, you know, if you talk to the person on the street, you know, there are often misconceptions about how and where AI is used. And oftentimes they relate to, you know, the bot apocalypse and just, you know, wild misconceptions about AI. What would you say is the biggest thing that comes up in your work about just people misunderstanding how AI is used?
You know, most fundamentally, most people think AI does more than one thing, right? They think about a neural network is like making a cheeseburger. It's like flipping buns and like laying things on. Like it's this bot that can do six things and lay the right amount of ketchup. When in reality, it's actually a lot less cool than that. Every single function is its own neural net. You know, every single function of the robot requires its own, quote, AI. That the AI that most people perceive is actually a collection of it. Like when you have a car that drives itself, it's not a single AI, not a single neural net. You're talking 20, 30, 40 neural nets that would run a Tesla, right? So I would say that whenever I come into that conversation, people start talking about AI, like running the world, you know, I often will kind of slow it down a bit and say, you know, but every single thing that needs to be done would require its own model.
I think something that's misunderstood is that when we talk about the role of AI in society, probably for the next 20 or 30 years, we're really talking about kind of the fusion of people with machines. It's really taking the output of an automated decision and almost always vetting it with some kind of human review or using AI to augment the intelligence of a human. And I think, you know, science fiction movies often, you know, cloud people's judgment. And, you know, I think there's a poor level of appreciation for how AI is actually used to complement humans.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So one of the things that I talked about with past guests, I'd love to get your take on this. Let's say fast forward even 10 years, not 20, 30, 50, but just 10 years. What is a task that you think humans will be assisted in doing by machines that today might, you know, just seem like science fiction?
You know, I think if we consider that this will really be driven by how people want to spend their money, right? Like how people decide every day they're going to, you know, like, I want to invest in this product or I want to buy this product. I think what we end up with is a consumer product in 10 years or less that is making your daily life a little easier. I think one of the things that might sound crazy now, and you actually touched on it a little bit, but it's, I think, emotional decisions, keeping track of everyone in your life is going to be something that'll be almost normalized by assisted AI. If you think about all of the forms of communication that come in, the different channels that we get, you know, through, you know, whether it be a podcast or a text message or email or a Zoom call, right? All of these are going to be processed into, you know, a collection of AIs that will say, hey, you know what? Dan is kind of stressed today. You should probably give him a call. And so that's something I think is going to be really normalized, is having this almost neural extension, this part of yourself that lives in a phone, a device, doesn't really know. I don't really know. But at the same time, I think we will wonder how humans ever held large scale social networks, like 50, 100 people before, when someone, you know, like my kids' kids will be like, you mean you just kept track of all 100 people in your life, right? Without having just this cool sort list of like, these are the people that are feeling blank today based on the communications you're getting.
So if you're coaching your kids about how to think about their careers and you want them to invest in skills that are timeless, that are not good candidates for, you know, autonomous, replacement by autonomous machines. What are the skills that you would think they should be investing in today?
Art and math.
Says the math major.
I have three kids, and I'm going to push them all to art and math. You know, I don't think machines are going to replace art anytime soon. I have seen a lot of the stuff that comes out and I'm mesmerized by it. I love it, right? But at the same time, you know, I think we can all agree that there's still some human component to art that I think is part of the experience, the journey that we all go through, that we identify with, that I think a machine would always struggle with, unless we, of course, forced the machine down the gauntlet of humanity, right? And at the same time, math is so fundamental, right? Like, you, when you think about math, you think about, you know, whatever the next discovery is, and it's something that you and I probably can't figure out, right? Whatever the next internet is in 1940, right? Obviously, it didn't come out in 1940, to be clear, but in 1940, if someone were to describe the internet to you, you'd be like, I don't even have the mental capacity, right? There's something like that out that you and I can't even figure out. And I guarantee you, math will be a critical part in making sure that happens.
I tell my kids similar things. Invest in creativity. Mm-hmm. Empathy, rational thinking. These are things that, you know, AGI, artificial general intelligence, I don't know, maybe 50, 60, 70 years, maybe we're close, but maybe not. Regardless, those are edges that people will always have over machines. And I don't think we'll ever be good candidates. And those are skills that I believe you have to seek out. They're not things that, you know, humans become experts at without really investing themselves in it. By contrast, I think anything that, you know, is replicable, or, you know, anything that is deterministic, I think in the future will be good candidates for full autonomous decision-making.
I couldn't agree more.
Luke, I gotta get you off the hot seat, but there's one more question I have for you. I'd love to get your take on this. So I know that you've worked kind of across the spectrum with different AI-related technologies, from machine learning to NLP and everything in between. Which AI-related technologies do you think are underhyped, in the sense that they have a ton of potential and you think in, you know, 5 to 7 years we'll be doing amazing things that we don't even realize are interesting use cases today?
I have two answers for that. Really old tech and really new tech. I think like gradient boosted decision trees that's an older tech. And honestly, if you have a smaller data set, you should not be going to the new fancy neural nets. You should be returning to older traditional machine learning, because at the end of the day, you just wanted to do something cool, and those will be much more successful for you. So that's one that's underutilized, just going to the fundamentals. And then the second, I would say embedding spaces. That's something that's going to be a much bigger part of our conversation in AI, is basically how do we represent things as an embedding space.
Talk a bit more about how embedding spaces are used today, and where you think they might go.
Yeah. So if you can imagine like this big, here's a good example. For anyone that's not familiar with an embedding space, I'll explain it real quick. Imagine an aquarium. I filled it with clear jelly. And then I took all these words, and like words like teacher and student and homework. And I put tweezers and I stuck them embedded in this space, in this jelly, in this aquarium. And I put teacher in one spot and student really close to it. I put homework a little closer to student than I do to teacher. And basically I take the entire English language and I place it in this space, this three-dimensional space. That's an embedding space. This way I can say router and router. Router is in the carpentry equipment, and router is in the electrical equipment. Can actually occupy spaces that say, oh, this belongs to carpentry, and it also belongs to electronics. Depending on the words that are used around it, I can be influenced one way or the other to say it is this kind. And so, high-dimensional embedding spaces, that's where you think about, instead of it being a three-dimensional aquarium, it's a 100 or 200-dimensional aquarium, which is something that our brains really struggle with, but computers do really well. And of course, this will be a good fusion of, you know, like how we think about problems. We're like, you know what? I know that in a higher dimensional space, I can solve this. And then we'll return to AI for that. And so problems, you can think about computer images, like how are these two images similar? Well, you put them in the embedding space. Or how are these two people in like a healthcare sense similar? Put them in an embedding space, right? If you want to know similarity, it's probably going to be the number one way you retrieve.
That's a fascinating concept. And unfortunately, we're out of time, but that feels like a great place to pick up on. Maybe we'll have you back in another episode, and we'll see how some of these ideas that we've been discussing emerge, but specifically this notion of embedding spaces. What do you think about that?
I'd love that.
Good stuff. Luke, where can the audience get a hold of you if they want to learn more about you and Arecor?
Yeah, you go to Arecor.com. It's ARRICOR.com. And we have our contact info right over there.
Luke, thanks for coming by. Thanks for hanging out. Great discussion, and look forward to continuing it in the future.
Same. Thanks for having me.
This is your host of AI and the Future of Work, Dan Turchin, signing off for 2021, but really excited about bringing you some amazing guests as soon as we kick off 2022. That's it for this week. Back next week with another amazing guest.